If you like what you see, please like and share the video and subscribe to the channel, turning on all notifications. If you would like to support this channel in any way, please do so through Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the description. You can also like and follow us on Facebook. The link for that is also in the description. Why do people choose to attend the SSPX? I'm not necessarily talking about those persons who go there simply for the Latin Mass periodically. I mean the people who have looked into the situation of the Catholic Church, researched the problem, and come to the conclusion that for the salvation of their souls and the souls of their family, they will in fact attend the Masses and receive the sacraments from the SSPX, rather than through the Novus Ordo. Even though the priests of the society disobey the hierarchy of the Church, offering the sacraments and catechesis to the faithful, despite the fact that they are suspended and forbidden to exercise their priestly function. What causes someone to come to the conclusion that this is okay or even necessary? To be fair, Rome has made many concessions in this area concerning the SSPX over the decades. The PCED has repeatedly said that you can go to an SSPX Mass so long as you don't do so to separate yourself from Rome. The excommunications of the bishops have been lifted, and the priests have received faculties for confessions and marriages. Still, the Church has made it clear they don't want people attending SSPX Masses. Yet, people do it anyway. Why? Well, I can only really speak for myself, but I do believe, in a general sense, my reasons are pretty much across the board. The reality is, since Vatican II, the mainstream Catholic Church no longer teaches the full Catholic faith. You see, people like me have researched the Catholic faith and discovered that what we have found is not reflected in the post-Vatican II Church. And even more disturbing, some of the things taught by the Second Vatican Council and the popes thereafter were condemned by previous popes before the Council. Also realize that the examples I could give are so numerous that one could not possibly exhaust them in a video like this, or even several videos, so I will give just a few to illustrate. And here's a very obvious one. In his encyclical Prescendi Dominici Gregis, Pope Pius X condemns the errors of modernism. At one point he describes the erroneous view of tradition held by the modernists, quote, "But this doctrine of experience is also under another aspect entirely contrary to the Catholic truth. It is extended and applied to tradition as hitherto understood by the Church and destroys it. By the modernists, tradition is understood as a communication to others through preaching by means of the intellectual formula of an original experience." So here we have Pius X condemning the idea that tradition includes preaching and our personal experiences. And quite frankly, this idea sounds rather ridiculous, doesn't it? If you were to ask 100 people what tradition means, I bet none of them would say our personal experiences and listening to the preaching of others. They would say it is something that we have done longer than anyone can remember, or something like that. But in the Catholic Church, tradition means doctrine or teaching, specifically the teaching from Jesus Christ to the apostles that's been handed down through the ages. This cannot include our personal experiences and preaching in general. An idea clearly condemned by Pope Pius X, yet Pope John Paul II said this in his condemnation of Archbishop Lefebvre in the Motu Proprio Ecclesiae Dei, quote, "The root of this schismatic act can be discerned in an incomplete and contradictory notion of tradition, incomplete because it does not take sufficiently into account the living character of tradition, which, as the Second Vatican Council clearly taught, quote, comes from the apostles and progresses in the Church with the help of the Holy Spirit. There is a growth and insight into the realities and the words that are being passed on. This comes about in various ways. It comes through the contemplation and study of believers who ponder these things in their hearts. It comes from the intimate sense of spiritual realities which they experience. And it comes from the preaching of those who have received, along with their rites of succession in the episcopate, the sure charism of truth." Here, Pope John Paul II says that tradition is living and includes our personal experiences and listening to the preaching of pastors. Do you see the problem? The Pope further explains that this idea of tradition, including our experiences in preaching, is clearly taught in the Second Vatican Council documents, and indeed it is. Quote, This tradition, which comes from the apostles, develops in the church with the help of the Holy Spirit, for there is a growth in the understanding of the realities of the words which have been handed down. This happens through the contemplation and study made by believers who treasure these things in their hearts. Through a penetrating understanding of the spiritual realities which they experience, and through the preaching of those who have received through episcopal succession the sure gift of truth. So why is this idea of tradition wrong? Well, the preaching may be heretical. Just because it's preached doesn't mean it's true. Every heresy was spread by preaching. Just because they have episcopal succession, that's no guarantee that their preaching will be sound. Every heresy began with the preaching of a priest or a bishop. Preaching does not have the guarantee of inerrancy. The First Vatican Council set out the rules for that. And even then, our experiences may be wrong. Even if the preaching is sound, you might misinterpret it. So let's recap. The Second Vatican Council teaches, and Pope John Paul II reiterates, something which Pope Pius X expressly condemns. Again, do you see the problem? Unfortunately, it doesn't stop there. Pope Pius IX said in Quanta Cura, "These persons do not hesitate to assert that the best condition of human society is that wherein no duty is recognized by the government of correcting by enacting penalties the violators of the Catholic religion, except when the maintenance of the public peace requires it. From this totally false notion of social government, they fear not to uphold that erroneous opinion most pernicious to the Catholic Church and to the salvation of souls, which was called by our predecessor Gregory XVI the insanity, that the liberty of conscience and of worship is the peculiar or inalienable right of every man, which should be proclaimed by law, and that citizens have the right to all kinds of liberty, to be restrained by no law, whether ecclesiastical or civil, by which they may be enabled to manifest openly and publicly their ideas by word of mouth, through the press, or by any other means." By the way, this is just one document out of many documents by many popes from the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries saying the same thing, condemning religious liberty and condemning the idea that civil authorities have no obligation to the Catholic religion. However, the Second Vatican Council says this: "This Vatican Council declares that the human person has a right to religious freedom. This freedom means that all men are to be immune from coercion on the part of individuals or of social groups and of any human power, in such wise that no one is to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, whether privately or publicly, whether alone or on association with others, within due limits. This council further declares the right to religious freedom has its foundation in the very dignity of the human person, as this dignity is known through the revealed word of God and by reason itself. This right of the human person to religious freedom is to be recognized in the constitutional law whereby society is governed, and thus is to become a civil right. The protection and promotion of the invaluable rights of man ranks among the essential duties of government. Therefore, government is to assure the safeguard of the religious freedom of all its citizens in an effective manner by just laws and by other appropriate means. The religious acts whereby men in private and in public and out of a sense of personal conviction direct their lives to God transcend by their very nature the order of terrestrial and temporal affairs. Government therefore ought indeed to take account of the religious life of its citizenry and show it favor, since the function of government is to make provision for the common welfare. However, it would clearly transgress the limits set to its power were it to presume to command or inhibit acts that are religious." Everything the popes have condemned in the area of religious liberty, the Second Vatican Council seems to uphold. If these things were an error then, they are an error now, and the Second Vatican Council is wrong on these things. But how can that be? How can the Church hold an ecumenical council and yet teach error? Simple. It's not an infallible council. Pope Paul VI said this when he closed the Second Vatican Council. But one thing must be noted here, namely, that the teaching authority of the Church, even though not wishing to issue extraordinary dogmatic pronouncements, has made thoroughly known its authoritative teaching on a number of questions which today weigh upon man's conscience and activity. Subsequently, in less solemn occasions, but even more clearly and precisely, Pope Paul VI affirmed that the Council, quote, "avoided proclaiming in an extraordinary way dogmas endowed with the note of infallibility, but rather conferred on its teaching the authority of the supreme ordinary magisterium. And I believe, as Archbishop Lefebvre did, had they invoked infallibility, this wouldn't have happened. Another problem with the council is its ambiguous language and the back and forth. It's this, but then it's that. On the one hand this, but on the other hand that. As a result, these documents can be interpreted in a variety of different ways. And since the modernists have taken over the church, the more liberal interpretation was implemented. Now, don't get me wrong, the council documents are problematic and some things cannot be reconciled with tradition, but the council never specifically called for all the changes that happened afterwards. Not to mention the absolute denial of Catholic doctrine. Here are just some of the things that I've heard. Priests cannot forgive sins. We don't know if purgatory exists. The feeding of the multitude was the miracle of sharing. We will not be judged for sexual sins. Vatican II trumps all other councils. The Council of Trent no longer applies. Mary sinned. And no, these are not isolated to my area. There has been ample testimony through the decades from all over the world to know that this denial of Catholic doctrine is a problem throughout the entire church. Now, I'm not going to dedicate a lot of time to the subject of the new Mass versus the Latin Mass. The new Mass is a mess. It's valid, but also a danger to the faith. Since its implementation, the numbers have plummeted across the board. Baptisms, marriages, confirmations, religious life, Mass attendance. A study shows that 4 out of every 5 persons raised Catholic leave the church by the age of 23. This was not the case before the new Mass. In Quo Primum, the document by Pope Pius V in the 16th century establishing the Latin Mass makes it very clear that that Mass cannot be revoked or dispensed of, and that no priest can be told to say a Mass other than that one. Now, one might say, okay, so Vatican II is not infallible, but neither are the condemnations by previous popes. It's all part of the ordinary magisterium, you know, those teachings that can change, and they did. Not so fast. The ordinary magisterium can be infallible when the pope reiterates the constant teaching of the church, which is what those popes were doing when they condemned religious liberty, among other things. But get this, in the very document by Pope Pius IX, Quanta Cura, condemning separation of church and state, religious liberty, and freedom of the press that I quoted earlier, that document also says this, "Amidst, therefore, such great perversity of depraved opinions, we, well remembering our apostolic office, and very greatly solicitous for our most holy religion, for sound doctrine, and for the salvation of souls, which is entrusted to us by God, and solicitous also for the welfare of human society itself, have thought it right again to raise up our apostolic voice. Therefore, by our apostolic authority, we reprobate, proscribe, and condemn all the singular and evil opinions and doctrines severely mentioned in this letter, and will and command that they be thoroughly held by all children of the Catholic Church as reprobate, proscribed, and condemned." That's infallible language. That means those condemnations are infallible and cannot change. Therefore, the statements in Vatican II to the contrary are heretical. And by the way, the language in Quo Primum establishing the Latin Mass uses similar language. With all of this in mind, what are we to do? Are we bound to accept error because of authority? No, in fact, we have a duty to resist it, even when it comes from the Pope or an ecumenical council. Saint Athanasius of Alexandria from the 4th century is considered a great saint and defender of the faith, but he wasn't so popular in his day. He was banished into exile several times for his defense of the divinity of Christ during the Arian crisis and even excommunicated by Pope Liberius. The church suffered a major crisis during the 4th century called Arianism. Arians denied Christ's divinity, proclaiming that he had been created. This was not a rival church to the Catholic Church, but rather a heresy within the church. A heresy proclaimed by most of the bishops and priests of the church and emperors of the Roman Empire. Arianism was condemned at the Council of Nicaea, which produced the Nicene Creed, but that was not the end of it. During the 4th century, there were other Arian councils held and rival creeds formulated that we don't recognize. We are often told that while the Arian crisis affected the majority of bishops, it did not affect the papacy, but this is not true. Pope Liberius, the pope that excommunicated Saint Athanasius, signed a heretical semi-Arian creed, although he did so because the emperor had him tortured. Athanasius didn't recognize his exiles and excommunications as just. So what did he do? Well, according to Cardinal John Henry Newman, quote, "The great Athanasius, as he returned from his exile, made no scruple to ordain in several cities as he went along, though they were not in his own diocese. And the famous Eusebius of Samosata did the like in the times of the Arian persecution. Epiphanius made use of the same power and privilege in a like case, ordaining Paulinus, St. Jerome's brother, first deacon and then presbyter in a monastery outside of his own diocese in Palestine." Of Eusebius of Samosata, the historian Dom Adrian Gray says, "Thus in the 4th century, St. Eusebius of Samosata is seen passing through the Oriental church devastated by the Arians and ordaining Catholic bishops for them without having any special jurisdiction over them." So while the majority of priests and bishops embraced heresy, Saints Athanasius, Eusebius of Samosata, and Epiphanius went into these men's territories, ordained alternative priests, set up alternative masses, and at least with St. Eusebius of Samosata, consecrated alternative bishops. Does this sound familiar? There is a striking parallel between the Arian crisis and the crisis in the church today. And we have an example of what the great defenders of the faith did. Today, they are considered heroes, but back then, they were considered disobedient and rebellious. How dare you come into my territory and set up rival masses? How dare you ordain priests and tell people not to go to my churches? Do you think the faithful weren't warned to stay away from these rebels? Of course, the "Thou shalt not attend the SSPX club" will quickly point out that while the situation with these three men from the 4th century may be similar to that of Lefebvre, it is not exact. These men did not disobey the Pope, and they did not break canon law. And of course, the circumstances are not exact. These things very rarely are. They're not exact because the situation in the church isn't the same. Canon law probably didn't exist at that time, and the prohibition against consecrating bishops without papal approval is new, like very new, like 20th century new. Now, I'm not saying that that means that it's illegitimate or anything like that, but I'm a big picture guy. And I think it's a little legalistic and short-sighted to say, well, today we have this law, which, by the way, would have prevented St. Athanasius and the others from doing what they did, so therefore it's not justified. You're missing the point. The highest law of the church is the salvation of souls. That's Canon 1752 in the new Code of Canon Law, and that trumps all other laws. Think about it this way. If the speed limit is 40 miles per hour, we are bound to obey it. But if my wife is in labor and we have to get to the hospital as soon as possible, breaking that law is justified. The salvation of souls is what gave these men the right to do what they did in the 4th century, and it's what gave Archbishop Lefebvre the right to do what he did in the 20th century. Okay, so what's the difference between the SSPX and Protestants? The Protestants make the same claims. The church has strayed from the Orthodox teaching, and this requires us to act. Isn't this just high church Protestantism? Well, the difference between Protestants and the SSPX is this. Protestants tried to change the constant teaching of the church. They denied the existence of purgatory and the role charity plays in our salvation, for example. Regardless of what they say, they wanted to get rid of these things that are part of the constant teaching of the church. The hierarchy of that time stood firm and upheld the constant teaching. Unfortunately, today it's the other way around. The hierarchy seeks to change the constant teaching, and the SSPX is standing firm and upholding it. And the only way for you to know for sure that I'm right or wrong on this is for you to take your faith seriously and find out for yourself what the true Catholic faith is. But let me ask you, which side constantly tells you, quote, "the church doesn't believe that anymore"? Read the councils, especially Trent, Florence, and Vatican I. Read the writings of the popes, Leo XIII, Pius IX, and Pius X. If you do that, you're going to find that the post-Vatican II church is not upholding the traditional faith. So why not become a Sede Vacantist? Because you don't want to desert Peter. Look, a priest, bishop, or even the pope can err in their private theological opinions, even if it's what they say in their preaching. That's the flaw of Sede Vacantism. They don't really believe that. The First Vatican Council said that the Pope is only guaranteed to be free from error if all these conditions are met. So what does that tell you? If all the conditions are not met, he is not guaranteed to be free from error, which means he could be. Now, of course, we don't assume that he is, but if it's shown conclusively that a council that's not infallible or a pope in his non-infallible teaching is in error, then we have a duty to resist it. Until my next video, God bless.